Lecture 21, The Delicacies of Investing in Infrastructure.
Politicians love infrastructure investment. It offers the immediate pleasure of pork barrel spending and government contracts, and in addition, it offers a promise of being a long-term investment in economic growth and prosperity. This lecture doesn't have much to say about the pork barrel purposes of public infrastructure spending, except you do want to keep them in the back of your mind. The focus here is on what extent does investment in infrastructure, that is, roads, sewers, electricity, phone lines, and so on, promote economic growth. At first glance, it certainly seems plausible there's a link between infrastructure and productivity. And again, what I want to do in this lecture is think about infrastructure in broad terms. So it will include the transportation network, roads, airports, seaports, the communications network, everything from telephones to the internet, electrical power, stuff like water purification and sewer systems, even schools and hospitals can be counted as infrastructure in some sense. It seems clear that economies which have these sorts of institutions work better and are more productive than others. Before we talk about those productivity links, let's try and put the quantity of public infrastructure in perspective. If you look at the overall U.S. capital stock, the U.S. Department of Commerce each year puts together estimates of the total stock of capital in the United States. And that's trying to take into account all the capital that's worn out or depreciated and actually describing what that capital is at its current value. This is a mammoth job, as you can imagine, and it's one of these numbers that's sort of interesting, although you might not want to quite take it to the bank. The total amount of capital stock in the U.S. economy, according to the Department of Commerce, in 1996 was $22.6 trillion. And of that amount, about 10% was the durable goods owned by consumers. About 60% was in the private sector. It was residential capital, equipment owned by business, other business structures. So the remaining 20% is the government-owned fixed capital. It's what we typically refer to when we mean infrastructure, that sort of publicly owned investment. And what we really want to focus on, to a large extent, is that publicly owned investment. You notice in size that when that's 20% of all investment in the U.S. economy, that's actually somewhat comparable in size to the total amount of all the equipment that's out there for all private sector industry. The total amount of government capital is $4.6 trillion. The total amount of private sector equipment and machinery is about $4.9 trillion. So really, this is an extremely large chunk of investment. If you break down the public capital stock into state and local and federal and different kinds of uses, what you see is that 72% of this $4.6 trillion is in the state and local sector. It's mainly highways, schools, hospitals, sewers, electrical and water systems. Of the federal government share is the remaining 28%. Out of that, 19% of the 28% is defense-related capital. And I won't talk too much about that here, but that's things like equipment, buildings, military facilities, stuff like that. And only the remaining 9% is federal government ownership of things like civilian buildings and equipment and highways and so on. Notice that the state and local sector really owns and runs an awful lot of the public infrastructure in this country, particularly some of the buildings, educational, and hospital systems. So this takes us back a little bit to our theme of privatization before and where the money is coming from and where it's going. Now, this is an enormous chunk of money. If you think about this investment that we have of $4.6 trillion in government infrastructure, if that's well invested and it's spinning off a return of, say, 10-15% a year, that should be worth hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the U.S. economy. Of course, if it's poorly invested, it may be spinning off very little at all. So there are real consequences here in thinking about whether infrastructure is helping productivity or not. A variety of studies have actually found a fairly firm link from infrastructure investment to productivity. There's been work on time series where they look at investment over time in infrastructure and how the economy does. A few years back, an economist named David Ashour at Bates College looked at public capital stock over time, and he compared it to productivity growth over time. He adjusted for some other factors, and he found, basically, that the investment in public capital stock takes a sharp turn down in the late 1960s and 1970s, and that's just about the time that national economic growth and productivity growth is also taking a sharp turn down. And so he proposed, based on various more complicated statistical findings, that there was a link between these two, and that lower public sector investment could drive down the economy as a whole. A variety of other studies have looked at the cross-state evidence, comparing state by state how much infrastructure investment there is, and comparing it to the economic growth in each of those states, and adjusting again for whatever other factors are out there, things like, you know, the skills of the workforce and so on, and they found some connection there as well. I'm not aware of big systematic international comparisons where you look at public sector investment country by country and public sector growth, but it's common in many studies of poor countries to have folks argue that if that country only had better roads or a better electrical system or a better phone system or better ports, that the economy would grow faster. So I think the evidence here is relatively strong, but I would be less than honest if I didn't say that there have also been serious and difficult questions raised about some of these studies, even after you've adjusted for various other kinds of factors out there. For example, it could be something of a coincidence in the U.S. economy that infrastructure spending slowed down in the late 1960s and 1970s, just about the same time productivity growth did. What slowed down in infrastructure investment for the U.S. in the late 60s and 70s was highway spending went down, but that was because we'd pretty much completed building the interstate highway system. There's also a slowdown in space spending after the Apollo moon landing, and a slowdown in military spending as the Vietnam War winds down. It doesn't seem likely that these are the primary reasons that productivity growth for the entire economy would slow down. The link between those particular kinds of infrastructure and productivity growth in the rest of the economy are just not immediately obvious. There's also something weird in those particular time series estimates. The estimates are effectively too big. Some of these studies find that when you invest in public capital, it helps the economy by up to 5 times as much as investing in private capital. Now, when you see that kind of a result, you sort of think to yourself, there's something strange going on there. And even if you aren't quite sure what it is, it just seems peculiar, and you wouldn't want to trust the result necessarily too far. Some of the comparisons across states and across countries face similar problems. And there's also this chicken and egg problem. Does a state like California have more highways because it's a rich state, or because it's a big state? Or did they build the highways and that helped it to become a bigger economy? And sorting out this sort of chicken and egg problem of investment, did it lead to growth? Was it a result of growth? Is it a result of other factors like geography? Those are difficult issues to sort out. So, having been honest and told you that the evidence here is a little shaky, I will tell you that my sense of the evidence as a whole is that it is strongly suggestive of the general idea that higher levels of infrastructure can, at least in some cases, give a real and significant boost to economic growth, but you want to be careful about pushing that conclusion too far. Politicians, of course, certainly believe that infrastructure spending is a good idea. Whenever the federal government or a state has some money to spend, proposals for spending more on roads in particular immediately come up. In 1998, for example, as it became clear that the U.S. was going to have its first budget surplus, Congress immediately pushed through this enormous highway and transportation spending bill. Frankly, a lot of that was just sort of pork barrel feeding frenzy, but why were they feeding in this area, in the area of highway spending, rather than, say, pork barrel spending frenzy in other areas? In part, I think, it's because of this sense that highway spending is not just pork barrel spending, but somehow it's good for productivity and it's good for the economy in some broader and deeper sense. But when you think about that particular example, all your antenna kind of go up. Is it really true that all these projects that were pushed through Congress to get some money out there to their districts are really helping the productivity of their districts? There's certainly reason to doubt it. There's certainly reason to doubt that pork barrel infrastructure spending is really doing a significant economic good at all, beyond what any other spending would have done in terms of pumping some contracts out there into the economy. So, although the link from infrastructure to productivity may seem pretty clear-cut, or as clear-cut as anything gets in this complicated world we live in, it's relatively easy to raise some hard questions about a lot of particular infrastructure projects and to doubt whether they're really providing the benefit that one might hope for. So let's question for a little bit the link from more infrastructure to higher productivity and question how we would think about when this connection might be stronger or weaker. One issue here is the issue of diminishing returns. When you've got a lot of infrastructure in place, adding to that infrastructure may not give you an especially big boost. This may be another case where building the first road or the first highway does give you a big productivity gain, but widening out that highway, adding an extra lane to that highway, the productivity gain may be smaller and smaller and smaller. Similarly, you could think about this with having electricity in place or having phone systems in place or really any kind of investment. The first steps are really going to have the biggest payoff. And then as we add more and more and more, the additional steps may still have some payoff, but the payoff is likely to be smaller and smaller. As we think about these additional steps in a U.S. context, we also need to remember that there are going to be good projects and bad projects. Even if infrastructure spending is good on average, it's perfectly possible that some projects are just silly pork barrel spending. It's perfectly possible that this could happen, just like it's possible to have silly private investments where firms make an investment that doesn't work out, or it's possible to have silly government regulations that impose very high costs for very little benefit. In all of these cases, the issue is really to think about cost-benefit analysis. Think seriously about the costs and the benefits, try to lay them out as clearly as you can, be clear on who pays and who receives benefits, and if you put that kind of analysis in place, you may have some hope of at least having the information out there to try and fight the pork barrel to some extent. These issues that infrastructure spending can have diminishing returns, and that politically speaking, you may get some poor projects in place. These are real issues, but they're not fundamental issues, I don't think. In fact, if you do good studies and you do good cost-benefit analysis, presumably you can really reduce the risk that either of these problems is going to be a big difficulty. But there's a more fundamental concern with pork barrel spending, or that goes beyond pork barrel spending. And it's the problem of infrastructure, of peak loads, and of pricing peak loads. Let me try and explain what I mean by those terms. When you think about infrastructure, what almost defines the term is the notion of some big network of things that's out there 24 hours a day. Most infrastructure projects have the characteristic that they are not used at a steady pace, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, even though physically the network is out there all the time. The question is, what's the peak load? How high is that peak, and how long does the peak go on? Imagine, for example, that on a typical road system, it might be that that road system is used 100%, really only 2 hours a day during the morning rush and the evening rush, and then the other 22 hours of every day and weekends and holidays, it's used much less. In the middle of the night, it might only be used 2 or 3%. If you think about an electrical system might be used 100% on a hot summer afternoon when everybody is using their air conditioning, but on a weekend, in the spring or in the fall, it might be used at very low rates. Maybe at only, 30 or 40% or some much lower number. You can think of telephones. During the middle of the day, when there are lots of business calls being made, then you sometimes call a big city. I don't know if this has happened to you, but you call a big city and you get a message which says, please place your call later. You've overwhelmed the peak of the phone system. But in the middle of the night, there are many fewer calls being made. So we have these systems of infrastructure, whatever the infrastructure is, which are heavily used at certain times of the day and much less used at other times of the day. Now, we really worry, of course, and for understandable reasons, about overwhelming the peak of our various infrastructure systems. We don't want them to be so heavily used that we overwhelm the system itself. There are high, high costs that happen if you exceed the peak of your infrastructure. For example, if you think about time spent waiting in traffic, the estimates are that in the 39 U.S. metro areas that have more than 1 million people, perhaps one-third of all car travel takes place with at least some congestion. Half of the delay happens on highways, the other half on arterial roads. Some estimates of the average amount of delay are, say, 2 minutes of delay for every mile of congested travel. You multiply this out by various estimates, 75 million drivers in these congested areas. Each driver drives about 10,000 miles a year total. They have a certain share of that as congested miles, and do all the multiplication and work it out, and what you end up with is that the country as a whole may be losing something like 6 billion hours a year to traffic congestion. If you multiply those 6 billion hours a year by some value of time, like, say, time is worth $10 an hour or something like that, then the cost of this traffic congestion might be thought of as something like $60 billion. Those are big, big numbers. And that's a cost of overwhelming the peak of the road infrastructure system. You can imagine this sort of inconvenience and economic disruption in a number of other areas when you overwhelm the power of the system as well. For example, when you have a power outage. I don't mean one because of a storm, but because in the middle of the summer everyone turns on their air conditioning and the system goes down, you've overwhelmed the system. Or when phone systems don't work because you've overwhelmed the system. These are not as much of a problem in the United States. Our infrastructure system is pretty good, but if you look at a lot of other economies around the world, you really see some serious problems out there. If we were to overwhelm the sewer systems and water treatment systems of this country, we could have some really serious environmental damage. If we were to overwhelm the airport systems, we could really have some safety concerns if we were trying to land planes really close together during peak times. So an obvious solution here is, well, let's try to build enough infrastructure that we don't overwhelm it at the peak time. Let's try and make sure we've got enough infrastructure that we don't get to this situation of congestion or where things break down. But actually, this solution has a lot of its own problems. If you try to build infrastructure for the maximum possible use, that is a very costly thing to do. Moreover, it only benefits the people who are using the product or the infrastructure at that maximum possible time. So what are we going to do here? It also means that if you do that, that the off-peak times have even more unused infrastructure that's just sort of sitting there. You can imagine, for example, with roads, that maybe you say, okay, we're going to build enough roads so we never have traffic congestion. So we're going to build, you know, by heavens, a 15-lane highway each direction. So there will never be congestion around a certain city. Well, you might avoid the congestion, but you're going to have a highway which is vastly unused for large sections of time. You will have built it at very high cost, and you will have built it so that only those people who were using it during the congested hours benefit from the many extra lanes that you inserted. Perhaps the best thinking on this subject has been done on traffic problems, I think. And in particular, I'm fond of the work of an economist named Anthony Downs at the Brookings Institution on this subject. He said, let's face it, we're just not likely to be able to build our way out of congestion problems on the roads. Why not? He said, consider what happens during congested parts of the day as congestion goes up on the roads. He said, three things are going to happen. One is people are going to take alternate routes. They're going to get on side streets and stuff like that. Another is people are going to travel at alternate times. They're going to go early or late. And a third thing is people will seek out alternate modes of transportation, like carpools or mass transit and things like that. Now, let's say that we expand the roads, we expand the highway, we build extra lanes to reduce congestion. What happens? Well, those people who did those other things shift back. People come from the alternate routes back to the freeway. People come from the alternate times back to the peak time. People come from their carpools and their mass transit back to the road in their single occupancy vehicles. And so the result is that as you build, you don't really reduce congestion very much at all. You just shift these patterns that people have built into place. As a result, Downs concluded, you really can't very easily build yourself out of a peak load problem, or at least it's going to be extraordinarily costly to try and do so. You can tell a similar story about electrical power or telephone lines. If you keep building to the highest level of capacity, people keep using it to the highest level of capacity, and you keep ending up building more and more. So we begin to have some doubts here about the value of adding huge amounts to our infrastructure to deal with our peak load problems. If it means building 15-lane highways that are used for 10 minutes out of every 24 hours, maybe that's not worth it somehow. If we build a lot of power plants that are only used on hot summer days and function and aren't really needed the rest of the time, that may not be worth it. Perhaps we need a different way to think about how we address peak loads and how we think about building infrastructure. And the alternative economists have proposed is, let's not just think about building to match the peak, let's think about flattening out the peak. Let's think about reducing peak load use. And for economists, the obvious way to reduce peak load use would be charge higher prices at peak load times. Build toll roads and charge higher prices during the rush. Have higher phone charges or higher electrical charges at peak load times. So let me talk about these sorts of charges and how they would work, and try and give you a broader vision of how we might somehow balance out the quantity of infrastructure we build with the efficiency concern that we don't want to just keep building for the peak load. We want to think about flattening out the peak and using that infrastructure over broader amounts of time, and spreading out that peak as much as possible. The traditional approach here, which has often combined private companies and regulation in the case of, say, the electricity and the communications industry, has been, we'll let private companies pretty much decide how much to build, although we'll have regulators watching what they do, and we'll influence their choices to some extent by regulation. The tendency in these cases of electricity and communications, as we talked about before, was historically to use cost-plus regulation, and thus probably to encourage overbuilding of capacity. They, in effect, did try to outbuild the peak to some extent, and the regulators encouraged them to do that. Traditionally, they were guaranteed a profit for doing this, so they just went ahead and built lots and lots of infrastructure. But there's at least potential out there to tackle these questions by pricing the peak somewhat differently. And in fact, some of the new forms of regulation out there can be thought of as ways to avoid building capacity and to think about working toward more efficiency instead. Again, in the earlier lecture on electricity and phones, we talked about price cap regulation and how it gives better incentives to improve efficiency. And regulators began to do things like encouraging the electrical company to conserve energy and to go out there and do conservation stuff in various homes, not just keep building more and more and more power plants. So they were able to sort of adapt regulation to some extent to say, look, our goal here should be to reduce the peak somewhat, not just keep building more and more plants regardless of what the peak turns out to be. But there's a lot more that could be done in this area. For example, why not have a special lower electricity rate for those who don't contribute to peak load use? One interesting example I ran into this past summer is that apparently at the University of Minnesota, where I work, on hot summer days when the system is running close to capacity and might be about to blow out the generators, the University of Minnesota has all its air conditioning turned off. And it has a deal where it gets a lower rate on electricity, but on hot summer days they promise to turn off all the air conditioning and thus avoid putting an extra strain on the system. In France, it's even more interesting. In France, they have this sort of nationwide wired system where you're allowed to make various choices. Say, for example, I agree that on hot days, my air conditioning will not reduce my home temperature below 78 degrees. Well, I can program that into my thermostat so that on a hot day, I'm not contributing to pulling down all the temperatures to 72 or 68 degrees. Or I could have air conditioning that turns off automatically, say, every night in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day when no one is home. Or I can have a gizmo where when I push my dishwasher, it's only going to turn on the dishwasher in the middle of the night when electricity demands are low rather than in the middle of the day when they might be higher. Telephone companies already charge peak load prices. That is, they charge more during the day when loads are high than late at night. They charge heavy users of conference calls and things like that more than your average person who's dialing a call direct themselves. So all those kinds of issues are ways in which we could price the peak differently for infrastructure and try and spread out the peak more and more. We're going to run into this problem more and more. It's going to be a serious problem for the internet. As people start doing live conferencing over the internet, live video, it's going to take an enormous amount of space. And if we don't think about how we price that space and charging people for what they do in terms of live video, it's just not going to work very well. They're going to eat up all the space and your email is never going to make it through. What about other cases when the government is the direct builder and owner of the infrastructure? So we're no longer talking about this sort of private sector, public sector regulation kind of situation. In roads, for example, the government is typically the direct builder and owner. The traditional pattern here has been not to charge tolls or only to charge short-term tolls to recoup construction costs for a time. I should say that although I'm going to focus in on roads here, these same issues arise when we talk about water systems, sewage system, airports, and all those kinds of things, but transportation is really the most obvious case. Why don't we charge more tolls, particularly tolls at the peak load, that is during the rush hour? One of the things that I find remarkably frustrating is at some bridges, you pay exactly the same toll if you cross at midnight when there's no one else on the bridge as you do right in the middle of the rush hour when everyone else is crossing. You want to use the toll to get people to try other things and to move outside of the rush hour. And if you don't use them for that reason, then you're going to continue to have really high congestion levels. Electronic tolls are on their way. They're technologically becoming feasible. You have a little electric beeper attached to your windshield or your back license plate, and you can be charged for crossing bridges or for going out on the roads in one way or another. I think that's going to become more and more common. We may also see requirements that businesses charge for parking instead of providing it free as a way of encouraging people to get out of their cars and try other kinds of alternatives. The idea here of economists is that the amount collected by these peak load tolls tells you something useful about how much higher to build the peak. Why don't you use the money from the peak load tolls to build the peak higher? And so the people using it during the peak time are actually the ones getting the benefit from the greater construction. Or, if you prefer, let the peak load users pay for our mass transit or something else that would help reduce the peak in some other way. And if you don't have the peak load tolls in place, you don't have a good idea of how much you ought to be spending. Instead, you just end up with large amounts of congestion. Now, these kinds of peak load charges are politically often grossly unattractive. And it's easy for people to say, well, you know, we just can't do that politically. I'm not so sure we can't do it politically. Peak load charges often seem unreasonable to people when they're suggested for roads or sometimes for electricity. But in many other cases, like you pay more for a phone call in the middle of the day, you pay more for air travel on certain routes or certain times of day, you pay more for mass transit during certain peak hours, a lot of the time, these sorts of tolls are widely accepted as being reasonable. So I think that these attitudes toward peak load pricing may not be as fixed in stone as people sometimes think. And if you put it in place, people's attitudes do evolve over time. It's also possible that you can spend the money in some particular way which makes people feel okay about paying the higher toll. Like if you use the peak load tolls for mass transit or for helping the poor afford these charges, for providing universal service of some kind, then people may feel more comfortable about them being collected for that way. But the real reason to focus in on these peak load charges is just that, in reality, we really don't have a whole lot of other alternatives. Sometimes we like to pretend that we don't really need to worry about peak load tolls. We'll just keep building. You know, we'll build some roads, then we'll build a mass transit system. Then we'll build, you know, this, then we'll build that. We'll add a bus system. We'll add high occupancy vehicle lanes. We'll just keep adding things. And somehow, by adding things, we'll avoid the problem of congestion. But in the end, most of those things end up not being all that cost effective. And so when they don't end up being cost effective, then we come up with nice methods of regulation. You know, we put things like the flashing lights on the freeway on-ramp that hold you back from getting on as quickly as you might like. Or we have these lanes where you can only go if you're a carpool and stuff like that. And then we find that doesn't work. And we keep sort of trying out these things as if we could just avoid this nasty idea of peak load pricing. And we could just get the right mix of vehicle lanes, the right mix of transit, the right mix of all these other things, then congestion would go away. But I think the truth is that either the regulations we have are going to be harshly intrusive, they'll work, but they'll be harshly intrusive and controversial, or the regulations just aren't going to be enough. Ultimately, the infrastructure question that America faces is, what do we want to do here with infrastructure? What do we really need? Do we really need a building boom where we pour a lot more concrete, we lay a lot more wire, we build a lot more airports? Or do we need a better pricing policy where we price at the peak and spread the peak out more and use our infrastructure more efficiently? Well, I mean, the obvious answer is we need some of both. I mean, there are clearly cases out there where infrastructure is crumbling, and if you're going to keep it, you're going to need money to rebuild it. In New York City, for example, the subways are soon going to be 100 years old. There are crumbling bridges and roads around this country, and we need to think about how we rebuild those. So in some cases, we certainly need more concrete. But I think I speak with a lot of economists in saying that if we want our investments in infrastructure to be productive, we may need a pricing policy even more than we need extra spending, just because we've done so little of this sensible pricing in the past. You can think about pricing possibilities for reducing electrical use and reducing peaks there, pricing for roads, pricing for airports to spread out flight congestion and encourage competition there, pricing for the internet system and the phone system to avoid peaks that will crash those systems, pricing for water so that we don't have to keep building dams. The sort of infrastructure boom that we saw in 1998 when Congress dumped money into the highway bill, just pouring money into highways, is probably not much of a route to productivity growth. But an infrastructure policy that's driven by careful cost-benefit analysis, that uses peak load charges, that incorporates elements of deregulation and privatization in some areas, as we talked about in earlier lectures, that kind of infrastructure policy could be a real contributor to America's future productivity growth.